I just want to start by acknowledging the colleagues from the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors, the policy consultant that worked with them, Julie Cross, Dr. Murray, our incoming APHA president, and Jennifer Talbert. I was able to work with previous presentations that have been made in order to move forward with this one. I've tried to start with the framework that takes into account the sort of a health reform definition, health equity definition, and then include this sort of a acknowledgement of what has occurred thus far within the HIV/AIDS programming and advocacy. I think most people are familiar with the AIDS epidemic and how it evolved in the United States and what kinds of people participation that led to the programs that we have today. So a combination of public health professionals as well as community activists worked together to arrive at the Ryan White Care Act, which we have today, widespread HIV counseling and testing. There's been reforms in research based on advocacy for both the care side of HIV as well as prevention. Community participation is a required input. There have been challenges made to the way in which pharmaceutical companies get their patents, do profits, and then we now have, which advocates had called for, a national AIDS strategy, which we'll talk more about later. Just a little history on the health reform. I think maybe many of you know this. You know, the Civil War was the post-Civil War was the first time federal support was provided to disabled veterans and widows and orphans. And even though that was a limited effort, those things were utilized as a precursor to think about what eventually came along as the Social Security Act of 1935. And as landmark legislation that was, it did not include a healthcare component. But historically, there was a spirited effort to get one. So the act passed. And even with that, it passed with the exclusion of domestic and agricultural workers, which by excluding those workers, it resulted in a de facto racial and economic disparity that continued all the way through the 1950s. And of course, 1965, Medicare and Medicaid were passed. And these really were part of the overall civil rights struggle. And for those people who were eligible for those programs, it helped to reduce poverty amongst those populations. Thank you. So in terms of the goals of health reform, there's been a long-standing health reform movement. We know, as was talked about earlier this morning in the plenary sessions, where the effort was around universal coverage, single payer. And the goal of that would be a future that would lead to health equity and social justice. What we had passed were some steps to that, but it did not start with the premise of universal coverage. It started with the expansion of health insurance coverage. And so that the goal for this is to eventually get to universal coverage. So it's some steps before the steps in which the activists carried out for health reform truly. Okay, thank you. All right, so what was passed with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act signed into law this year? It was absolutely most far-reaching healthcare legislation since Medicare and Medicaid. It established a mandate for all U.S. citizens and legal residents to maintain health insurance coverage, and it made some significant changes into the system, both in terms of private health insurance, Medicaid, and Medicare. As you know, it's going to be phased in over a few years, and the landmark year perhaps will probably be 2014. So now, in terms of looking at the population, in terms of who's insured, this will, by 2019, according to the Congressional Budget Office, will have a reduction in the number of people in the country who are uninsured down to 8%. But with that, yes, thank you. They also estimate that 23 million will still be uninsured in 2019. And who are the people who will be uninsured, most likely? Immigrants who are not residents or undocumented. People who are eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled for some whatever reasons. And people who are exempt from the mandate because they couldn't find affordable coverage. And then there are those who pay the penalty in lieu of getting coverage, but many of these uninsured will be low income. So now, health as a human right still remains an issue in 2010. We have obviously an economic recession with double-digit unemployment. We have more than 50 million Americans uninsured, and that's growing as high job loss occurs, which has an impact on people living with HIV as well. And we know that 65% of all bankruptcies are health-related. HIV in the United States and globally, around the world, 33.4 million people are affected. And in every country in the world, it is disproportionately affecting people living in poverty. And in this country, that is also true. With more than 1.1 million people living in the country with HIV, and the estimate by the CDC of 56,300 new infections annually. Half of the people who live with HIV in the United States do not have reliable access to HIV care, 29% are uninsured, and 21% do not know that they're infected. In terms of health equity, the overarching principles, which were talked about this morning from the World Health Organization report in 2008, improve the daily living conditions of people's lives, tackle inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources, and measure and understand the problem and assess the impact of action. Now, these are the tenets of achieving health equity, which, again, is this long-range goal that we're trying to achieve. If we could go forward. So, on an issue of health equity as it relates to HIV, in 2008, a report was done by the Black AIDS Institute that premised that if all African Americans in the United States were looked at as a country, it would rank 16th in the world in the number of people living with HIV and AIDS, noting that more than 600,000 people who are African American are living with HIV, and up to 30,000 are becoming infected each year. So you could see that more than 50% of that 56,000 every year becoming infected are African Americans in a country where only 13% of the population is African American. And looking at the impact on HIV and life expectancy, that same report said that this hypothetical Black America would rank below 104 other countries in life expectancy. So it also looked at the number of countries, seven of the 15 countries that received support from the U.S. Global AIDS Program, this would outrank those seven countries. A study that was done just this year and presented at the International Conference on AIDS in Vienna was by the CDC that looked at HIV and poverty. And it came out with basically statistics that look very similar to the original Whitehall study and some of the other social determinant studies that shows that the poorer the person is, the higher the probability that they would be HIV infected. And so with this particular study, they looked at African Americans, Latinos, and whites, and these were, I'm not sure why they focused on heterosexuals only, but that's what they did. And so they interviewed these 9,078 people in 23 cities, and then they went to test them, and 188 people tested positive for HIV in a group age 18 to 50, and 55% were women, and 75% had incomes at or below the threshold for poverty. Now, even the whites who were tested, the poorer they were, the more likely they were to be HIV infected as well. So again, speaking on this issue of health equity in order to deal with healthcare reform and HIV in particular with that, there needs to be an emphasis that takes into account these structural issues in addition to healthcare itself. Immigrants as a part of the population in the United States, this is just an overview of who the immigrant population is. But this is a big issue in terms of HIV and AIDS, but I would think anything associated with healthcare reform. If you see the population of immigrants, about 4% of the population are undocumented by the Kaiser Family Foundation, estimating 11.9 million. That's significant in terms of HIV and AIDS. So what's the issue here, and that is the undocumented. Undocumented people have and need rights to be respected too. And in terms of HIV and AIDS, this is a population that would be left out of healthcare reform. If we could just go to the next one. So the next few slides, we're going to show what elements in healthcare reform are relevant for people living with HIV. Certainly they're relevant for all people, but I just want to bring this out in terms of what it means for people with HIV. That it would eliminate discrimination based on health status, so on pre-existing condition. It encourages employers to provide insurance coverage and extends dependent coverage to age 26 and eliminates lifetime insurance caps on policies and plan rescissions. If we go to the next one. Under Medicare, I would say the important element there for Medicare and people living with HIV and AIDS is that benefits associated with the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which is part of the Ryan White Care Act, would count toward this true out-of-pocket cost that would cut this donut hole down for people on Medicare. And it would also provide a rebate of $250 to Medicare Part D beneficiaries. Under Medicaid, which is maybe the greatest impact in terms of people living with HIV and AIDS, it expands to people under age 65 with incomes up to 133% of poverty to join this program. And for a family of four, that would be $29,000, an individual $14,400. HIV and AIDS is a disease that disproportionately is male, and about 75% in this country, 25% female, and it disproportionately affects childless adults and adults who are non-custodial parents. And of course, as you know, Medicaid is going now to expand to childless adults, so it should have a significant impact in terms of people living with HIV and AIDS. And I would say the other thing that would be important to take into account, as you know, many people living with HIV and AIDS have comorbidities. And for those who are recipients now of Ryan White Care Act funding, the drugs on the formulary for ADAP are basically HIV medications, but for those patients who have other conditions, as they move into Medicaid, the prescriptions for their other medical conditions could be covered as well, which would be a stronger package if we go forward. The other area of health reform, which could have, we expect would have a significant impact on people living with HIV and AIDS, is the infusion of resources that is being provided to community health centers. Community health centers are among the elements in the social safety net that provides a lot of HIV care already, especially in rural and underserved areas. Many community health centers have Ryan White funding, and community health centers, in the way that they're structured, do allow people to be served regardless of their immigration status. If we could go forward. So this gives a picture of the most recent data we have on funding for HIV and AIDS. If you look at this, you could right away see that the smallest amount of funding is in prevention. But the care and treatment, which is 50% of this $24.8 billion, of that about $6.2 billion is Medicaid, $4 billion is Medicare, and $2.2 billion is the Ryan White Care Act program. Now, the Ryan White program, and the formal name Treatment Extension Act of 2009, was first enacted by Congress in 1990. It's administered by the Health Resources and Services Administration, HIV/AIDS Bureau. As noted, it's funded at $2.2 billion. It is the payer of last resort. It's available in all 50 states and U.S. territories. And it was reauthorized four different times. And note this, the next reauthorization is scheduled for 2013. We can go to the next one. So in the Ryan White Care Act, there's several components. I won't go over these in all the details, but I just want to pull out a few things. Number one, Part B includes the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which is significant for all or most people living with HIV and AIDS who are serviced in this way. And Part F, which includes dollars for dental programs, it includes special projects of national significance, two of which I'd like to point out that are really important that set the tone for how we work with two different populations. Within the special projects of national significance was a demonstration project to implement HIV services for people, specifically targeted for people coming out of prisons and jails back into the community. Another one that's really important in special projects of national significance is the ongoing border program that occurs through the southern border of the United States and Mexico that allows for services to be provided on both sides of the border, given the back and forth nature of that population. Great lessons have been learned from those programs, which would not have been possible to learn had it not been for an arena like this in which for that to happen, excuse me. So the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which is financially probably the biggest part of the CARE Act, goes to all 50 states. About 200,000 people are on this program, or about a third of all people living in the United States. And just so you know, this is not an entitlement program. We talked about the reauthorization that has been occurring every 4 years, and that's tied to being able to keep people going with their medications and services. So in 2008, you could see the racial and dollar breakdown in terms of income of ADAP clients. So about 73% of people on this program were living at a poverty level of under 200%. When you get to 2009, the 77% living at a poverty of 200% or less. And by the time we get to 2010, we now are entering into major waiting lists around the country for the ADAP program. So in the beginning of July, there were 1,781 people on waiting lists in several states around the country. And as of the end of October, there are 8 states with waiting lists with over 4,157 people right now waiting for medications. There was even an infusion of $25 million back in August from the Obama administration, and it did help to eliminate some waiting lists, but it has not zeroed this phenomenon out. If we could go forward. So again, this is an important program, but it's not an entitlement program. And one of the reasons why there are waiting lists is that many states around the country, including my own, are in a budget crisis. And this is a program that is funded as a federal state partnership. And so many states do not have or are unwilling or have difficulties in terms of matching up with the demand that's coming forth, primarily based on people who are living with HIV, had employment, lost jobs, thus lost their health insurance coverage, and therefore now are applying for ADAP and are eligible, which is now moving forward with these waiting lists. Another element that I think has to be taken into account is the positive piece. More people are living longer with HIV, therefore they're alive to reapply every year, which is an excellent thing. And there is an aggressive movement now for routine HIV testing. More people are being identified with HIV and being brought into care. But when brought into care, they need to be able to get what they need. So if I could just, I'm sorry, oops. Thank you. So let's just list some of the things, and I won't spend too much time in terms of what Ryan White services are in place. But we have patients serving as advisors, peer leaders, community health workers. And the next one, we have prevention programs that are going on that need to be preserved. And then finally, which is really important, are the structural issues that take into account these issues of health equity. Few other health conditions have housing assistance, utility bill assistance, emergency cash assistance. Few other programs have free legal assistance. And finally, the National AIDS Strategy, which is now being proposed for achievement by 2015, we have to look at these things in order to make that happen. If we could go to the next one. Now, as mentioned, 2013 is the reauthorization of the Ryan White program. That will be coming up. It will still be needed. But I and maybe you, if you can, we can share with each other, feel that there will be those who will think we don't need to keep Ryan White because 2014 will have health reform and that'll be all we need. But I would beg to say differently. In 2014, expansion of Medicaid will be helpful, we think, in terms of the program. But it won't be helpful for undocumented immigrants. It won't be necessarily helpful for people immediately coming out of prison. And in 2015, we have these target years for the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. If the issues of reauthorization and the healthcare reform have any repeal components, it will have an impact on whether or not we can be successful with the national AIDS strategy. And finally, in order to get to health equity, we have to take these things into account: the structural, the medical care, the quality, and as well as the public health infrastructure. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mildred. So another excellent example of a critical public health program that's going to have an interface here with health reform and what will happen and where will it go. We have a couple of moments if folks would like to come up to the microphone and make a comment. We'd really enjoy that. But really, we all need to be thinking about how do we position public health, given health reform coming, in the most positive fashion. Please, could you just say your name, where you're from, and then as quick a question as you can.
Thank you. Lillian Shirley from Multnomah County, Oregon. I have a question for Dr. Johnson. A lot of states are looking at figuring out a way to make a lot of our accountability much closer to the community and community processes. So whether you call it health care districts or regionalization organizations, how do you see us struggling on the state level to make sure that the kind of state top-down program that you're talking about gets incorporated into regions so that people can make decisions, you know, on that level, particularly when we're talking about trying to get to global budgets?
Do you want to take that, Josh?
For anybody, but I mean, you know, it's just kind of a generic problem that I see moving from where we are now to where we want to go.
Let me make sure I understand. So your basic question is, there are a lot of state programs now. How do they get melded in this new structure and the new funding?
Well, if we're going to have accountable care districts and regions, and we're going to break a couple things to global budgets, how do we move from where we are to there without losing, you know, some of the good work that's being done through this categorical program?
Yeah. I think that it's tricky. It's not going to be smooth in every case. And let's just take a couple of examples. I think that the HIV one is really important. As this excellent presentation indicated, HIV has a wide range of services, which is very different than any other disease and categorical. This AIDS, quote, exceptionalism has led to a lot of services which have supported people in very different ways than other diseases. And we have an evolution from this disease as something that was thought as a relatively short-term, frankly, death diagnosis to one where a lot of people are living very productive lives on the good therapy. So the premise that started this and what's happened since then is different. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussion of how to make AIDS more in the mainstream. And the question is then, how do these other wraparound services get dealt with? I don't think we know the answer to those kind of questions. For other kind of categorical programs, I think that there's going to be a big push for comprehensive care and for one organization as an accountable care organization to, in fact, be responsible for at least healthcare service delivery, if not health, of the population. And so I think that some of these categorical programs are going to wind up folded into that. And what's important is to retain the best of them and to make sure they don't get lost in this process.
Yeah, I wish we had a lot more time, because we'd better be very careful about assuming that accountable care organizations are actually going to have anything to do with anything outside of clinical medicine. They may not at all have anything to do with population health. That's why we have to be very careful as public health to be involved in how that evolves. Why don't we take these questions as quickly as you can? Go ahead, please.
My name is Molly Williams, and I'm from Susan G. Komen for the Cure. And I think these are three excellent examples of programs that have come about largely as a result of advocacy. And one of our challenges, I think, is going to be that as advocates, the group that's going to be left uninsured is the group that's probably the hardest to advocate for: undocumented immigrants, people who've recently been released from prison. So I'd be interested in the panelists' thoughts about how we can approach the issue of advocacy for groups that are considered by many to be undesirable.
Excuse me. I would try to be brief. I think immigration reform is a public health issue, and I think that that may be an angle in which to advocate. I would also think that correctional health in general is a public health issue, and that no few people that are in correctional facilities will always be there. They will be coming back to the community, and if we're serious about reducing recidivism, we need to have support services for people who are coming out to help them have a better chance of staying out. And I would think that from a public health perspective, we have studies that have shown already when screening is reduced in jails, STDs and other kind of rates go right up in the community. We need to roll those studies back out to make the case with those policymakers, much as what was described this morning.
Please.
I certainly could if we had another 3 hours, but since we don't, I'd be happy to talk with you after this about who best to contact within our department. Electronic health records are a huge area in itself, and I don't think that we have, I mean, there are a set of standards and approaches, but there are a lot of different systems out there, and how those all are going to work together to get a composite picture, I think, is a trick. And I think we're going to get there, but it's going to be lumpy because we haven't mandated a particular system. We basically put a lot of money out and said, you know, try different things. There are only a couple of great examples, I think, of electronic health workers records in a unitary way. Kaiser and the Veterans Administration, I don't mean to fault others, but certainly those are the best examples to look at. I want to say just one thing about advocacy. I think advocacy is extremely important, and we cannot confuse what's happened with saying that we don't need to advocate anymore, because we do need to advocate very, very strongly, and we need to advocate not only for the health care, but if we're in this room don't advocate for focusing on the other determinants of health, dealing with the issues of social disadvantage, dealing with economic issues, dealing with racism, then we're not doing our job. That's the value added of public health. Don? Dr. Jacobson?
I'm going to round out the set of questions. I recently read an article about how legal assistance, this goes back to the social justice and advocacy role, especially for women in the immigrant population, and not even knowing what their rights are, and how we as either a public health department would find a way to offer that legal assistance. Or through the healthcare sector. I read an article in Health Affairs recently that said in the medical clinic there should be a way to provide legal assistance to identify sort of health and all policies, solutions, and provide that assistance. I'm curious what the panel thinks about how both the healthcare sector and public health could
Well, we need healthcare people that have a public health ethos. That's the first thing. So we need better exposure to public health principles and prevention principles broadly in medical schools and nursing schools and all health professional schools. I think that's a fairly limited part of the curriculum that needs to be strengthened. But I want to just make one other point about this issue of advocacy and about the disadvantaged populations. We have not been strongly enough making the productivity argument. Health and productivity are related. I mean, for example, we don't have enough drug treatment for people getting out of prison that have significant drug problems that got them in there. What's the chance they're going to recidivize? Very high, unless you get them treatment. that's a drag on the economy because the prisons aren't inexpensive. And versus jobs that in fact create tax revenues. We need to get on the same wavelength as those who are worried most about the economic issues, even though they may not share our predisposition in terms of ideology with public health.
Very good. There's also in the health reform, there are these community care teams that have been created. And in a couple of states, North Carolina and Vermont, those community care teams have a public health worker on them to actually notice what's going on in the community and take it back and look at the public policy. So one example of integration that's been successful in at least a couple of states. Unfortunately, we do have to cut it off. I'm sorry, you have to get to your next session and we have to get ready for the next. For the gentleman who didn't ask the question, why don't you come up? Because we're hostage in this room for another few hours. So thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it.